It's nearly 4 months since President Obama declared an end to the American combat mission in Iraq. The last U.S. combat troops left Iraq earlier this fall, but the country still has nearly 50,000 American service members in non-combat operations. And now, 9 months after a close national election, Iraq has a government. Current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki cobbled together a coalition of Shiite, Kurdish, and Sunni parties to remain in office, despite coming in second in parliamentary elections. President Obama hailed the development, but as the head of the group Refugees International said recently, lack of security severely inhibits any humanitarian work in Iraq. And Iraq remains one of the few countries where diplomats live in a heavily fortified area they cannot leave without a massive security escort. So what's the reality on the ground in Iraq? Anthony Shadid, Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times, stopped by our studios recently. He's in the U.S. on a working break. And I began by asking him about one of his recent reports. It was after a suicide bombing in Iraq's Aroba Square. 10 people died. Anthony was there that day.
You know, it's often really frustrating, I think, for journalists in Baghdad, especially journalists who have been there for a while, to try to bring something new to the reporting about violence, about these bombings. And I went there that morning to write a story about what had happened, these bombings that had transpired across the city, across Baghdad, in which 10 had died. And I remember getting to the scene and looking here, and I was writing in my notebook, trying to find that detail that would somehow bring alive what had actually happened to readers. I mean, 10 people had died. It's not a small number. And I looked up at the building. I looked up at the facade of those buildings, and you saw wires dangling, windows shattered. You saw the glass on the ground. And then I realized what was so tragic about this scene that I was taking notes on was that it was somehow ordinary, that this scene could have described anywhere in Baghdad. And I think it's the ordinary for a lot of reporters that really haunts you, how ordinary in some ways the violence has become. So ordinary, in fact, that I think in some ways we've lost touch with our readers. And, I think we all grapple with that frustration of, how to still convey what is still a very difficult situation in a country that doesn't attract as much interest as it once did.
And you say Baghdad is a city living on bitter nostalgia. And what you also found at that square was also a bitter argument about the American invasion.
Right. It's amazing, 7 years later, 8 years later almost, where these same arguments that we heard back in 2003 still happen. It's remarkable in some ways. And at this market, where this bombing had just happened, there were two parties arguing about what the invasion represented. Is it a liberation? Is it an occupation? Was it the beginning of a civil war? Was it the end of an older Iraq that we once knew? And they were still argued with the same vehemence that you might have seen all those years ago.
As you say, it's been nearly 8 years since the U.S. invasion, and President Bush in his new book recently reiterated his belief that Iraq and Iraqis are better off for it. How does it look to you on the ground, though?
I'd say that's a breathtaking argument to make. And I think even to be able to say that argument without adding at least some ambiguity or some gray is almost it's almost unconscionable. I think when you work in Iraq and you live in Iraq, you see how devastated, how traumatized that country is. The repercussions of this invasion, of an occupation, of a civil war that claimed maybe 100,000 lives, perhaps far more, a place in which no one you meet hasn't lost a friend or relative. I mean, this is a society that is shattered. And so to make any kind of sweeping claims about losing or winning or better off or worse off, I think it's, I think you almost by necessity have to introduce ambiguity and degrade what this represents. It is a society that's devastated, that won't recover probably for a generation. And, may the long-term impact be something different. It might be. But right now, it's hard not to see much other than a lot of sorrow and grieving.
And you write about hopelessness. One shopkeeper who spoke to you says, "We are in a coma." And a policeman said, "I can't stand up to the terrorists. I have 4 children. Who will help them? The government?" I don't think so, as he answers his own question.
Exactly. It was amazing. Just going from, as you kind of reported that story, these bombings that we started off with, as you reported that story and kind of saw how the blame game was, how it played out. One person blamed the next, a minister blames a deputy minister, blames a parliament maker, blames this, blames that. And then it finally reached a policeman, and he said, "Yeah, I blame myself. There's no way I'm going to stand up to these people when I have a family to feed." And, that whole notion of just kind of helplessness. And I think it's been a part of the Iraq story since the beginning, this idea of what can we do to stop this? And so much frustration out there that we can't stop it. And it's still something you hear very, it's still very pronounced.
And at the same time, you meet this bookstore owner who said nobody in Iraq has any idea of what's happening, what has happened, what will happen in the future. It sounds like there's so much uncertainty. And I think we as Americans don't always hear that.
I think this, you know, that quote that you just mentioned, it's remarkable, I think, on several levels. I had met his brother, a man named Mohammed Hayawi, back in 2003, in fact. He was a bookstore owner, you know, a friendly man, you know, always wonderful to talk to, always welcoming. And I remember back in 2003, this is just a few months after the invasion, he had said those very words to me. We don't know what happened, what's happening, what will happen, you know, in the future. 2 years later, he was killed in a car bomb. It was a car bomb that tore through his street, a famous street in Baghdad called Mutanabi, wrecked his bookshop and killed him. And I went back to see his brother, who still worked on that same street, a few months ago. And I said to him, I said, you know, I remember Muhammad, your brother, had said these words to me all the way back in 2003, and I'm wondering what you think of them now. And he said, I believe the exact same thing. Those words ring as true today as they did back in 2003. And I think that's what like you said, it is difficult for Americans to understand that sense of Iraq. I mean, I think we're always kind of wedded to this linear notion of events that, you know, there was an invasion, there was a withdrawal, Iraq is on the path to democracy, and we leave. And, you know, Iraq is anything but linear. I mean, I think, in fact, mm-hmm. it's often deja vu time and again in terms of the violence, in terms of the stalemates, the deadlocks, the tragedies. Very little feels linear about it.
Another story that you write about, the attacks on Christians in Iraq, you know, really brought out the inhumanity of what's going on there. Thousands of Christians are fleeing because of recent attacks, especially from the cities of Mosul and Baghdad. And you say that Iraq was once a remarkable mesh of beliefs, customs, and tradition, but the targeting of Christians has drawn another border in a nation defined by more war, occupation, and deprivation.
Right.
How is that playing out on the ground?
You know, it's so interesting. I think when we think of the Middle East, we think of this kind of monochromatic region. I mean, a region of Arabs and Muslims. And in fact, it's a region of remarkable diversity. And I think one story that we've seen kind of play out over a generation is the loss of that diversity. And not only in Iraq, but in the Arab world in general. And what struck me with it after this just senseless, meaningless massacre of these Christians at the church was that in some ways we had, you know, taken just perhaps just, one more thread from this fabric, from this diverse fabric that once was Iraq, and it was, you know, unraveling yet again. I think in some ways when people look back at this era of Iraq, they're going to see this as the era that, you know, Iraq did lose, or kind of lost that ability to embrace its diversity, a tolerance of each other. Identities have become much more hardened. People, I think, there have drawn lines between each other. And, you know, what's the reason for this? There's a lot of reasons. Invasion, occupation, civil war, of course. But even when those events are going to be forgotten, I think the legacy of those events and the sense of what it's done to identity, hardening of identities, is going to live on, you know, far longer.
That's New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Anthony Shadid. We'll return to our interview with him after a short break to hear the story of one Iraqi family's harrowing search for the body of a son who was killed and why Anthony keeps going back to report from Iraq. And later in the show, rating President Obama in the lame duck session. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our interview with Anthony Shadid, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Anthony is in the U.S. on a working break, and he came into our studio recently to tell us about the reality of Iraq on the ground. We've been hearing of how difficult it is to communicate what life is like for Iraqis, the sense of hopelessness in a country where everyone Anthony meets has lost a loved one, and where the devastation and trauma are still too close for most Iraqis to make any sense of the last 8 years since the American invasion. I asked Anthony to tell us about a powerful story he wrote recently. You can read it by going to our website, hereandnow.org. It's about an Iraqi man looking for the body of his 33-year-old brother, with the whole family going through a harrowing, dehumanizing journey just to find their dead.
You know, there's a backstory here, actually, too. I was, You know, it was coming up on this August 31st deadline when the administration was claiming that combat had ended in Iraq. And my newspaper was doing a series of stories, and you know, what we call legacy stories, trying to somehow, you know, take a look back at what had happened. And the story that I was going to do was on, in a lot of ways, was death. And, you know, when you try to grasp something so vast as the idea of death in Iraq, in a country, like I said, that's lost so many tens of thousands of people, you know, I was at first overwhelmed, and then I realized that, you know, and I think this is a lesson a lot of journalists learn over time, is that you can say more by, you know, saying less. You know, the smaller stories in some ways allow you to say something bigger. And this was an example of that. And I went to the morgue in Baghdad and waited there until a family had found, you know, very sadly what they were looking for, and that was a picture of a lost son. And this relative of theirs had gone missing in 2005, 5 years before. And that's what they started with, was his picture. And from there, they had to find the body. And it was like, as you said, an immiserating experience. It was grueling. And, they did spend 8-9 days going from ministry to ministry, official to official, just trying to get the paperwork that would allow them to go to this vast cemetery south of Baghdad in Najaf to find his body.
And it shocked me to hear they had to pay for the paper in order for one official to write a letter giving them permission to claim the body.
You know, it reminded me, and I may get this wrong, but it reminded me of the Cultural Revolution in China when you had to pay for, or maybe it still goes on, but you had to pay for the bullet when you were executed. It felt equivalent in some ways. They had to pay for the paper that they got a letter. At one point, one official asked for a pen to write something down, and she kept the pen. It was just this incredibly brutal experience of trying to navigate the Iraqi bureaucracy.
And in that story, several people you spoke to said it was better under Saddam Hussein.
You know, and I think that's not even if you despise Saddam Hussein, or you know, or even if you were a victim in some ways of his dictatorship, and it was a brutal dictatorship, there's no question about that. I think you still hear, and you used this word earlier, I mean, I still think you hear this kind of narrative of nostalgia, not for Saddam Hussein necessarily, but for the time he represented. You know, I think for a lot of people, you know, the vast majority of us are not political. You know, what we worry about is, you know, our children, you know, what we're going to eat the next day, whether we have enough money to get by. And I think those questions in some ways were not as, the circumstances weren't as dire before the invasion as they have been since. And that, I think, becomes a very powerful thing for people to reflect on these days.
Well, let's go back to the politics for a moment. You know, there's a government forming more than 9 months after an inconclusive parliamentary election. What do you think it's going to take?
You know, I think this goes back in some ways to this idea of legacies again. And I've used that word a few times because I think it's a powerful way to understand how early in the process we might still be in Iraq. There was kind of a famous quote by a former American ambassador in Baghdad, and I'm going to misquote it, but the idea that we're still really in the first act of a play with many acts. We're still in the preface or the prologue part of this experience. And I think this government could be seen that way. You know, it's a government that the Obama administration has hailed as a diverse national unity government. I think what we're really going to see over the next year, though, is a government that's kind of inclined toward deadlock, inclined toward paralysis, the tough decisions that have to be taken, and really no tough decisions, political decisions have happened yet in Iraq. It's going to have a real tough time making those decisions. And so I think, you know, what we want to see this is in some ways the epitaph to the American experience in Iraq. We're at the last stage, a government's formed, and it will preside over the withdrawal of the last American troops. I think in some ways it's setting up the very difficult, perhaps unsolvable problems that Iraq faces right now.
You also paint great pictures of the Americans in Iraq zooming around in shiny Humvees. And again, I think most Americans feel like we've pulled out of Iraq. We don't have a very strong presence. But what do you see on the ground?
I have to say, you don't see the troops all that often in Baghdad itself or in the cities. They have left the cities. They are often on the bases. But there still is a sense that of an American presence. And I'm trying to think how I can describe that in concrete terms. 50,000 troops isn't, it's still a large number of troops. You still have places like the airport, which is a vast stretch of the city, in American hands. You still have the Green Zone. And the Green Zone, you know, however much it's turned over to Iraq, is still going to represent very much an American symbol of this experience since 2003. So, you know, while there has been, you know, a withdrawal of, you know, more than 100,000 troops from the country, there still is very much an American presence and kind of an American sense to the place, which I think is going to go on for a lot longer.
Anthony, you're home for the holidays. What's it like to be home, and how do you feel about going back to Iraq?
You know, I come home quite a bit, so it's not, I've kind of gotten over that that shock of going, of leaving a place that's still tense and still somewhat isolated to a place that's the opposite of that. You know, we do work in a bureau where we don't get out as much as we'd like, and it's not, you know, you get out for work, obviously, during the day, but you stay home at night quite a bit. You know, I think it's interesting when you take a step back, why do reporters keep going back to a place like Iraq? And I think a lot of the reporters there, you know, they remember the early days in 2003 when there were hundreds of us, when every single facet, aspect of life in Iraq was covered. And now they look today and there's probably 15 of us left, maybe a few more than that. But and I think most of the reporters who are still there have been there for a long time. And I don't want to, you know, be self-aggrandizing or anything, but I mean, I think there is a sense of, I think a lot of those reporters probably feel a little bit of a sense of responsibility to see this through, to see this to the end, especially at a time where Iraq is just not a story that a lot of people feel engaged in.
Sounds like you feel that way.
You know, I do. I think it's, in some ways, I think this is a story, I don't want to say a story of the story of my generation, because that makes it sound like it makes it sound crass, to be honest. But I do think this was a seminal event in a lot of our lives. Our country decided to invade another country, and we're still dealing with the repercussions of that choice. I think we do have a responsibility to see what happens to that and take responsibility for what that legacy is going to represent.
Anthony, thank you so much for your reporter's notebook on Iraq.
My pleasure.
New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Anthony Shadid. Tomorrow on Here and Now, imagine Christmas without lights. That was America during World War II. But in 1945, the war was over. And tomorrow, we'll look back at that Christmas celebration. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.